Okay, we have one question from the gentleman in the middle, the lady behind. So, in deference to the Paratex, ma'am, please. Beg your pardon? Okay, I haven't brought time into this at all. So, bring time into it for us. Okay, good. And so, do you want to talk a bit more about that? Do you want me to say a word or two on that subject? Okay. So, madam, excuse me, I don't know your name, but the lady has said, God's time is not our time. That's quite right. And actually, it helps us to explain and understand a bit what I alluded to briefly at the end, the doctrine of the sovereignty of God, that is to say, God is in control of everything. The Bible teaches that God is timeless and eternal, which means that he, so to speak, stands outside of time. He sees time stretched out before him so that he can see the beginning and the middle, and our future, and our past, and the end, and off forever. Whereas we only experience time one moment at a time. Time is a constraint that we're bound by. We live moment by moment, and yesterday's gone, except as a memory. But to God it is real and there. And God, because he stands outside of all that, like he stands outside of space as well, he's able to sustain it all in being. That's what we mean by the sovereignty of God. God keeps everything in existence. And so, because God is faithful, and because God is kind, and he wants us to have a world that makes sense, and that we can live in, God keeps stuff moving around in the same kind of way. He keeps the laws of the universe roughly the same as time passes. Is that the kind of thing you were angling towards or thinking of?
Yes,
Yeah, something that's all right. Yes, it's quite hard to imagine what life is like for a being who is not constrained by time. Yeah, thank you. Thanks. Sir, you had a question.
What I think from that experience is that time is actually a very difficult thing to define and come down to. I'll throw a caveat, this is amusing, but I had trouble with British Telecom recently. So I tried to tell the billing department to say they're going to cease serving me because I want to transfer my telephone. But, time is what the billing department said it is.
That raised telephone operator was having a bad day, it wasn't he or she. Okay, there was another question. Go on.
That was really interesting, wasn't it? Yeah. And that's one of the big questions which I think Londoners, there are three things which I think might be interesting to expand a bit. One is built into the scientific concept that we have to live with is an inheritance of what, for want of a better word, could be called civilization.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, a huge part of human spirits and physical engineering and order, basically. And underneath that, that I, if you like, the sort of locomotive of the whole lot of it, which is that you can't understand it at all in terms of the way these elements fit together unless you use the word that I noticed used a lot of times, Steve, which is the word law. That is, could it be law in terms of civilization, it could be law in terms of what we know as a legal system, it could be law as a physicist is talking about it, as a biologist is talking about it, but we are accepting inside that something called order. But alongside it, if you like, this engine needs six wheels, not two, to describe it. It needs a pair more, which are to go in reverse, which is negative. And what is a negative? And that's a huge big question, because it drops through one of those quotations, because a lot of them depend on the negative or even double negative. And there's a third bit that goes with that, which I think is even more problematic from the point of view of just taking a scientific view or just taking a surgical view. And that is that it goes back to the first remark. You cannot have a civilized order if you don't take some learning from others, from other people, from other species, from other elements of our ordered cosmos, or right down to the level of quantum physics of the particle. So I think it's a bit like the locomotive. You need this coupling work. You need the coupling work which is called civilization. And actually, it's possibly the most important bit of our civilized order. And that, I think, where it comes extremely close to our Christian heritage.
I think you're right. And I mean, there's a lot in what you said. And just to pick up one point, a lot of our heritage and a lot of actually what people, Christian and non-Christian, think of as good about their heritage, in fact is Christian ethics, Christian law, Christian social order, and so on. And we have another question. Gentleman at the back, and then lady here. Yes, please.
I wonder if I could ask you to give us your definition of the broader one rather than the narrower one.
Yes.
That might be available to us. But if you could do that, but before you do that, I noticed that some of the quotations from some pretty eminent scientists,
yeah,
we don't have the context.
Yeah, no, sure.
Quotation. But it almost seems to take a static view of science. The United reports science is inherently dynamic.
Dynamic in what sense?
Well, in the sense that the body of scientific knowledge grows,
yes,
and you say it evolves.
Yes, yes, yes.
As one brick is put upon another.
Yes.
And it is a long time to get to electricity.
Yes.
It's made a lot of it.
It's a long time to get to the wheel.
It's a long time to get to vacuums.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so then,
yes,
all of that good that they support to us.
Yes. Now, I think you're right. As to a definition of science, I'm slightly reluctant here. It's a little bit like asking to define marriage. Okay. Well, I kind of know what it is, but and I'm happy to try and describe it, but I wouldn't want to try off the cuff to give a definition which is supposed to exclude other things. But I suppose I'd say science is the pursuit of understanding the world around us by systematic, controlled observation and experimentation. So science differs from just looking at things and wondering about them. Science seeks to control the environment in which phenomena take place and to exclude extraneous factors which might influence what's being observed, and therefore to isolate particular phenomena and their effects in the world. That's a fairly hand-breaking definition, but you see how that differs from just walking in the park, looking at the trees, seeing how they grow. There's more. You're attempting to control your observations. Now, your second point about the dynamic character of science, I think that's absolutely critical. To recognise that 120 years ago, Lord Kelvin said that we've pretty much discovered everything that there is to discover in physics. I mean, that was before Einstein. I mean, talk about red-faced. You see what I mean? So there is a danger of this hubris of the moment where we imagine that where we've got to is unchallengeable. It's much better, I think, to acknowledge that if the world lasts for another 10,000 years, we will look back on the status of our knowledge now and see it is incredibly fragmentary and primitive. Or people will look back on it. And so to be slightly less bold about certainly about what we know now. Yeah, so thank you. It's just the humility, actually, that you find in the best scientists all the time. Thank you. Madam, yes.
Sorry, I'm going to slightly away from...
Fine, no.
Going back to what you were talking about, the only thing I think that I have slightly issue with the ethics and morality section.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't understand how you can say that there's a sort of transcendent deeper morality when you can't... I just feel like we... the people are asked, you know, feel it comes from our society. There are societies like a cannabis tribe that we would see as completely disgusting and wrong.
Right, okay.
But for them that's absolutely fine, and even themselves they would see that as right. Yeah. And I don't see how you can say that that's a transcendent thing when that's actually just
deep rooted
in our history.
Excellent. Now, it's really helpful because you put your finger on the issue. So let's take the example you've given. Let's take a slightly more provocative example, if I may. Let's take an example we're all familiar with, Nazi Germany, Second World War, and the attitude to eugenics and to the Jews and the Poles and so on. Now, here we are in our social world, we say that's abhorrent. There they were in their social world saying this is the right way to behave, this is the right thing to do. Now, if they had won, would you be happy to concede for the sake of argument that they are right?
It's not that the reason they lost was more because of military strategy.
Sure, yeah, but we're not now thinking about the reason they lost. What we're thinking about is if you think of ethics as merely socially constructed, then every time you say that's wrong, you shouldn't say that. You should say, I and my friends disagree with you. That's all you're saying. If ethics are a social construct, that's all you're saying.
I agree with that.
Right.
Sure.
Now, if you really think that, then I don't think you do. I'm being provocative. But just imagine societies, and you named, you know, cannibalistic societies. You don't really think, do you, that people who practice cannibalism, or eugenics, or who abort children because of their gender, or in the news today, female genital mutilation, again in this country, you don't really think that that's just a different set of cultural conventions. You don't actually think that. Actually, as I said those things, your stomach turns. And the reason your stomach turns is because your stomach, like the rest of you, was made by somebody who says, no, something is just wrong. And the fact that we are not, here's the key, I'm rambling a little bit, but the fact that we are not willing, with those extreme examples, to say, no, it's just social convention, is a signal to us that ethics is more than just social convention. Right. So, come back at me, come on.
I don't think the only thing, I do understand a lot.
Right,
I
sure.
I can't say obviously that I don't see that as
a exactly.
But then equally, I don't see how, I can't make the leap from that sort of level to say it's a transcendent thing.
Right.
I can't see how then they can't do this wrong.
Okay, that's fine.
And
that's good.
There's examples of things like with people like psychopaths, it's a part of their brain that's damaged or missing.
Right, okay.
And that's why they can't understand right and wrong that they've got
so empty. Yeah.
So I see that there is a scientific element that comes in
right.
the sort of psychological
now,
area.
And where you're taking this, I mean, you're moving fast. I mean, you're all keeping up. You're all very sharp here, right? what you've done is highlighted, okay, we look at another society and we think, that's revolting. And then actually there are some things in us which are revolting. What if we're made by a God who is good and all of us have gone wrong differently? That would fit, wouldn't it? And that would fit with what the Bible says. And so we see the things where other people have gone wrong but we haven't. We see those as wrong. And as a Christian, that means you come to life and you say, okay, there are some of my moral instincts which are good and right, and there are some of them which are wrong and need to be challenged. And then you discover that when God came into the world, he went around actually picking a fight with pretty much everybody. He said, you've got this wrong, you've got that wrong, you've got this wrong, you've got that wrong, you know. And that's what the prophets did, that's what Jesus did, you see. So I think it makes sense with both, you know, this is cut it short now, the doctrine of creation, God has put good in us, and the doctrine of sin, we've gone bad. Does that make sense? And if you put those two together, those two Christian doctrines are the fundamental pillars of Christian ethics, and actually any ethics. mathematical system that's going to work, I think, alongside a doctrine of revelation which says that God has told us. So you need to put doctrine of sin alongside creation. Is that making sense?
Yeah.
Magic. You moved along really fast. Thank you for that. Mark, do you want to say something?
No, Dick,
do
you want to say something?
I just wondered if you've seen or read of the materials brought about by Alan Miller in Australia.
Talk to us about him.
Well, he's the fellow that says the reincarnation of the genius.
Oh, right, another one. Yeah, no, I'm afraid I've not come across the latest man who says. Yeah. Well, again, this takes us back to another version of the issue, I don't know your name, Leigh was mentioning, that sometimes we get things wrong. And sometimes we get things quite dramatically wrong. Not so much morally as just personally. You know, thinking that you're Elvis, thinking that you're Jesus. Sometimes in that category. Some people just get that wrong. That can be explained if we are both created by a good God and somewhere along the way something bad has happened to us. Yeah, thank you. So,
very brief comment on that. There's a phrase in the Bible, everybody did what was right in their own eyes.
Yes.
When everything goes wrong in
society.
Today we have the same situation. Everybody does what they think is right in their own eyes. That's
right.
Going back to creation and evolution, when Adam did this trials around the school, and we did chemistry, biology, and
the other one.
It's not the other one, Mark.
I was taught to call that scientists came up with a theory, they did practical experiments, and they either prove that the theory is wrong or prove that the theory is right.
Yeah.
So therefore, evolution actually will only ever be a theory. So we should start to a 3.4 billion years with it.
Yes, that's right. And so at that point, you're right. I don't want to press this point too hard because it could abstractly, the evolutionary biologist might say, it could still be right. So in other words, it is fair to ask people who question the scope of the theory of evolution, let's say. It is fair to ask people like me to come up with something. And I just think it's interesting that people now have. And it's not been many decades since Darwin. Now, in the light of that, I think we need to just take a good long hard look at it again. And again, let me see the look on your faces. You're thinking, I can't have agreed with this guy until he said that. Well, of course. Because, you know, seriously, you got like a person who went to school even, never mind went to university, who's questioning the theory of evolution. Yeah, it's staying right here in front of you. Because I think it's open to question.
It seems there's an inheritance that they can't actually, in a sense, prove the whole theory of evolution.
Right.
Or one of the theories of evolution, so it's a several other. And yet, we're all expected to believe that it's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, life does evolve from now to now. You know,
right.
The changing climate and whatever, people change a little bit, we'll be taller than you.
Yeah.
But sort of tell you that the whole thing is.
Yeah. This is where it becomes problematic because. There's a danger this dominates the discussion, and I can see it's not going to, because you know, you guys here, you know, think we can see beyond this, but let's say a word about it. Either the theory of evolution claims so much that it becomes open to the kind of questioning that Stuart Kaufman highlights. Nobody knows how life began. Or you scale it back a little bit, you make the claim more circumspect and slightly smaller. You say, organisms that are better fitted for life will survive longer and be more likely to reproduce, which is basically just a truism, which isn't claiming much at all. So you end up oscillating between the big claim, which you make, and then somebody challenges it, so you scale back to the small claim, and then what actually happens is you snuggle the big claim in under the radar. And I think that's an unhelpful way to go about it. I think now that we have the mathematical tools to analyse the data, that is to say DNA chain, I think there's work to be done, really proper work to be done, and it's not going to be very easy to do it in a scientific environment. You can't even open your mouth to raise a question without losing your job. There's a gentleman back left here who's been very patient, thank you.
I've heard Fred Adler, what's your mother working now, I've heard of computer evolution taking place in 24 hours through my appearance.
Right.
But we are very different to animals. I've never seen an animal that can believe in something it can't see.
Mm-hmm.
Or have a faith in something it can't see.
Yeah.
And we seem to be different from that point of view.
Yeah, I think you're right. You've highlighted a couple of really significant things here. The first is that what you've seen in your professional capacity is evolution by artificial selection. Of course you can breed long, thin... Have you seen Mark's dog? A 9 foot long and 6 inches high. Where's that come from? Well, it's been bred for that. So people have artificially selected, not naturally selected. Little critters to make them weird. I don't know. Winston's machine twice, I think. But the difference in the animals, I find this is fascinating. Sometimes the rhetoric from the evolutionary world is so strongly aimed at saying we're all part of the same biological family, there are no differences between us, that people make a huge song and dance out of even the smallest attempts of other creatures to use tools. Now I think they're little macaques that really use a really cool, they drop rocks on stones and it's absolutely amazing, but they're dropping rocks on stones, okay? It takes them 5 years to learn how to do it. You know, I've got a six-year-old daughter, okay? She's not a genius, but she can do more than that. There's something, of course there is intelligence in other creatures. Of course there's dolphins and monkeys. But if you put them on a scale, they're some way from silicon chips, aren't they? So there is a qualitative difference between us and everything else. And the other issues you mentioned
prior to that.
Very British. It's like, this is the difference between here in London, you know, you get to a roundabout. In London, it's like, straight over it. And around here, everyone's waiting. And,
oh, okay,
yeah.
I'm going to
ask,
you
body of evidence that challenges the theory of evolution. In truth, there's huge amounts of different bodies of evidence to challenge it,
yes.
And I think most of them are probably wrong. Okay, so questioning evolution doesn't commit you to agree with everybody else who questions evolution, because they might do so for all sorts of dopey reasons. Okay, there's really, really bad creation science. What I mean bad. Dismal, you know, it makes me cry to listen to people talking about it. The thing that I find most persuasive personally, from a scientific viewpoint, goes like this. And I said this kind of thing earlier, but let me try and say it again. The evolution of a complicated organism like us is equivalent to the evolution of a long, long string of complex data from a much shorter string of simpler data. The data is the stuff in your DNA. Therefore, you can ask the question mathematically, is it possible to generate lengthy, complex strings of information from short, simpler strings of information without any intelligent input? Can you just generate that randomly? And the answer is emphatically no. It just isn't possible. And you can prove that mathematically. Now, it seems to me that that result from information theory hasn't made its way into biology yet. Do you see what I mean? And I think when it does, it will rock the boat. Because then there are two big challenges for evolution. There's how did it get started, which is already a problem. And then how, even if it did get started, did it go from simple, small strings of information to complex long strings of information. Does that make sense? I think both are a problem.